Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Welcome, everybody. It gives me great pleasure to see you all here this evening to celebrate poetry and the poetry of Mark Perlberg and to remember a generous and loyal friend of the Poetry Center, one of the founders as well, Martha Friedberg. My name is Kenneth Clark. I'm the executive director of the Poetry Center. And thank you. For the last 29 years, the Poetry Center has presented through its annual reading series hundreds of the world's poets to the people of Chicago. This is the last of the Poetry Center's 29th annual reading series, and tonight is no different from any of the other ones. If you allow me to brag a bit about the progress of the Poetry Center over the last year, well, I'm going to hold you hostage to that right now. Our tickets that we've sold this year are up 200% compared to this time last year. We are on target to have 400 dues-paying members by December of 2002, and this is unprecedented in the Poetry Center's, I think, very meddled and merited history. So I'm excited to report that to you. The outpouring of support for the Poetry Center gives me great confidence and our board great confidence to go into our 30th year providing poetry for the people. The Poetry Center does all this, and especially recently does all this, because of the help of many people, including and importantly the School of the Art Institute, where we are in residence and have had our home for 20 years, officially and unofficially for a while as well. Financial support comes from Poetry Center members, the Lannan Foundation, Target Stores, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency, the Polk Brothers Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, the Fred and Susan Novi Family Foundation, the Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Chicago Community Trust Young Leaders Fund, the Northern Trust Foundation, and lastly, but not leastly, the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. So that's a lot of people helping, and it is encouraging to me. Without further ado, please welcome Ricky Peterson. She's a board member of the Poetry Center, and she is going to introduce tonight's poet.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for that and for everything. Mark Perlberg, you hear me fine? Mark Perlberg is one of the founders of the Poetry Center. He stayed with it through thick and quite thin and is still serving on our board. Mark is one of the rare poets nowadays who has worked not in the ivory tower, but in what the rest of us like to think of as the real world, like William Carlos Williams and Wallace Stevens and Thomas Lynch, who read here last month. He won a poetry prize as an undergraduate and did try graduate school, but it didn't fit him very well. What he remembers is that they required four foreign languages. Instead, he wielded his pen with Time Magazine, the World Book Encyclopedia, and Encyclopedia Britannica. It seems to me that this life choice shows, for Perlberg as for us, poetry is not a job, but maybe an essential luxury. He's published in The New Yorker, Poetry, Hudson Review, Prairie Schooner, Rhino, etc., etc., etc. He is just now returning from a Lannan literary residency. His first book, The Burning Field, was published by William Morrow. Mark Van Doren's blurb on it says, "No poet of our time is more generous in his affections." One of my favorites from this collection is How My Great Uncle Louis Died Laughing. In poems like this one, Perlberg is already bringing us news of ourselves by conjuring up heroes and demons from his own past. The second book, The Feel of the Sun, was published by Swallow Press. William Stafford wrote, "In these poems, there is a commitment to getting it right. Through strange, unexpected stories, we find ourselves both surprised and confirmed in our inwardness. One small treasure of a poem called Graffiti asks, how to put it briefer, better? The cosmic grumble, I ache, therefore I am. The newest book, The Impossible Toy Store, is published by Louisiana State University Press. Liesl Mueller wrote, it is the best collection of poems I have read in a long time. The toy store of the title poem is impossible to the little boy because his new stepfather takes him there, perhaps to bribe him with a gift. Impossible. Perlberg gives us this same stepfather in quite a few poems with compassion and admiration. And finally, as the poor man is abandoning his stepfamily, apparently, standing on the sidewalk, and this is a Perlberg symbol bestowed with poker face understatement, standing on the sidewalk, dwarfed by the baggage he carried. Another childhood poem about hurting his mother is so simple, there is only one single adjective in it, white. He sees in his mind's eye her white arms at her sides. This is very drastic economy. The simplicity itself captures a world that seems to us inherently lyrical. It strikes the precise note that evokes our own long-gone summer or fall, our own island. Such poems open from an evocative detail into an almost meditative state, which we as readers enter and share. Placing a poem in time, he takes us past time. Music and art can be the starting points, or an image recorded with minimalist brushstrokes. Memory, trance, myth, dream, ghost story, even silence itself become alternative realities, full of treasure that we finger. The poet paints a cave and pulls us inside. But these are songs not only of innocence, but also of experience, sometimes terrible experience. Prague, beautiful, historic Prague, is erasing itself. The napalm children of Vietnam have the same expressions in a photograph as our own children being lifted out of their bathtub. Hatred blossoms inside us, as darkly as crystal teeth inside a geode. In such poems, the poet's moral vision raises unanswerable questions, leaving us with him at the edge of seeing. The voice is as intimate as the one inside your head. It is deeply civilized and unswervingly honest. Each poem says exactly what it means. What it says raises questions in us of ours. When the poet tells us this can matter only to us, we're honored to be included because, he says, we are talking not of evanescent things, but of the bones and marrow of the world. We're one-on-one. The poem Poet to Poet starts with a bit of advice from a fellow poet. Don't let the bastards get a bead on ya. As Perlberg says elsewhere, this is a message from the deep kitchen of childhood. Pass it on. Mark Perlberg.
Thank you, Ricky, very, very much for that really generous, terrific introduction. And I want to thank the board for scheduling this reading and all of you for coming. I'm going to start tonight, as we do on these Martha Friedberg nights, with some words about Martha, and I'll read them. Let's see here. Martha was one of the founders of the Poetry Center. She was a most gracious, elegant, and lovely woman, and a dear friend who served on our board of directors from the center's inception till just before her death in 1977. And I'm told by my daughter, who is a Friedberg, by marriage, that Martha's birthday was yesterday, or would have been yesterday. Her leadership, usually exercised behind the scenes, her judgment, generosity, were key to the birth and growth of the center. She was treasurer for several years, a job she disliked, but one that enabled her to contribute anonymously whenever we were in a financial pinch. And we learned of this kind of thing that Martha did over and over again, largely after she died. With her wonderful, tall, lanky husband, Stanton Friedberg, a distinguished surgeon at Rush Medical Center, and for a time chief of the medical staff, she contributed to music of the Baroque, the Newberry Library, and other things. But as she often said, the Poetry Center is my baby. Martha was all these things and did all these things, but at heart she was a poet, and a very fine one, though largely unrecognized, except by a few peers. She published two volumes of poetry, both privately printed in limited editions, with beautiful woodcut illustrations in color. Their titles are The Water Poem and Others, and Finally. I hope that what I'm going to do, and we haven't done this before, is read one of Martha's poems. I think she would like that a lot. I also want to remember Lou Barron, a longtime associate of the Poetry Center, through his wonderful wife, Enid, another friend. Enid really is the brains behind Hands on Stanzas. Lou died unexpectedly, very suddenly, in an accident last week. But here's the poem by Martha. It's called Beethoven's Birthday. If anybody can hear, can you all hear? Is it fuzzy? Am I too close to the mic or something? Oh, you know, it just depends on where you're sitting, I guess. Okay, Beethoven's Birthday, from Finally, Vixen Press, Winnetka, Illinois, 1981, design and beautiful woodcuts by Carol Seidenberg. Deep in Wisconsin for days on our pond, ice silences things. The bass and the bluegills dream in the opal light. Earth feels for new snow, and snow falls here, blessed by Mononymy heavens. We came for the weekend with our portable Sony. You nap, I type, and let daylight die. But it's Beethoven's birthday. We ought to be dancing with him and linking arms, the three of us singing his joy. Nobody phones. The loons have gone and the meadowlarks. There isn't an outcry, not a scuttle or print on the pond. Life looks for the brilliance of life in the fur of the dark, in the crystals. So, for my own poems, I've kind of grouped them, and I hope you guys can hear well. I've kind of grouped them this for this reading in along themes that have interested me. The first theme, or whatever, is art. I've loved it since I was a little boy. And that's another story, I guess. So the first poem is quotes from The Impossible Toy Store, and it's called, it's about Pizarro. It's a self-portrait. It's a really great painting, not very large. It's in the Tate Gallery. He stares at me like my conscience, looming before a window open on a street in Paris. His life is almost over. He says, "This is who I am." All is dark and silvery, the fall of his beard, light glinting on a rim of his half glasses. The window silvery behind him. He says, "The world doesn't flow in circus colors. That vision isn't serious. It moves in plainer shades, browns, greens, cloud colors, and this buoyant silvery light of Paris." He says, I prefer what happens again and again. Peasants in a row mowing, patterns of movement on the boulevards, shifting yet the same. A farm girl in a violet dress, head awkwardly bent, musing over her bowl of coffee. Garden Vision, after a poem a painting by that name by Paul Klee. It is a soft night on the streets of my city, with gold October burning in the air. The sky is palpable, smoky, remote from the glass-hard sky of winter. We have been given Rilke's two more golden days. It is time to wander after work under rustling leaves, saffron streetlights toward my autumn garden. It will appear at a turn of some unlikely street. Maybe there will be a stream beyond a patch of thistles patterned with leaves, a stone path worn smooth by desire, a shell of a tower, each brick burning within like the yellow flares of the leaves, a sundial, its blaze sheathed in the dark, a pumpkin moon glowing like a heart, and at the far end of my garden, a wall etched with signals and runes that will tremble as I read them into meaning. A poem about a wonderful painting by, piece of calligraphy, very quick, done by Nolde. The master, Emil Nolde, paints the sailboat. Like a great Chinese khan, you slap the paper with an ink-filled brush, tilt it, drag the brush a bit, and an ocean appears. The day on the paper is empty with fog. There is no horizon at all. You stroke the paper gently there and here, and patches of space bloom near the hint of birds turning in the slope of a wave, between the sailboat that moves out from your hand in obvious salt air and the flaccid sea that now lifts and slides. And the last one in this group is called The Bewitched Mill, from a painting by Franz Marc that's over in the Art Institute. At least it was when last I looked for it, which is some time ago. Okay. I watched a tape of Seamus Heaney down in Marfa, where I was, and he goofed up during this reading, so I don't feel too bad if I make a few mistakes. A great poet. The Bewitched Mill, by a painting by Franz Marc. Water falls on the great wheel, and at the gathering pool beneath the mill, blue animals drink, and birds on branches flash and sing in the arch of falling water. Some beasts have come to drink that they may never die, others to be whole again, but some move out of the woods toward the rumor of the dusky waters so they will not forget down the fall of years the possibility of exaltation. I could go on with art poems. It's almost a characteristic of the poetry of our time. Lots of poets have written poems about paintings. Now I'm going to move into some family poems, some of the things, the poems that Ricky was thinking about and writing about. And the first one is a prose poem, and it's called Summer. Summer. I am watching the gardener trim our lawn. He pushes a mower with a wooden handle over the grass, making dark stripes where he cuts. The blades purr, sending up a little stream of green as he pushes and pulls the mower forward and back. The green arc sprays into a canvas grass catcher hooked to the mower's wheels. I sit on the steps and tease a beetle with a blade of grass as it moves up the slate walk. On the long summer days between the times when the gardener comes with his truck and his men to trim and edge the lawn and cut the long hedges, I cut the grass, pushing our wooden mower. Or maybe I only dream it, because I am very young, and the sweet grass smell engenders dreams. I water the lawn with the long rubber hose, sending a fine buzz of water tickling down my arm, dripping on my sneakers. Each day is stretched, is strangely long, and when the sun presses on the tops of trees at the edge of the town, it floods the lawn with the clearest watery light. Mother talks with someone on the porch. Their voices blend with the purr of the mower and the hiss of the water. The house is cool and airy. The winter rugs and drapes and bedspreads have been taken up and stored in the attic. The chairs wear cool summer coverings that are crisp and shine a little in the afternoon light. We still live in the big brick house at the head of the river. Father hasn't died yet. Next poem is called In the Theater of Memory, and it's there's a phrase from it that became the title of this new book, The Impossible Toy Store. And it has to do with my stepfather and my dead father. He died when I was very young, and five. But anyway, that death left a big shadow down the line and down the on the poems. In the Theater of Memory, I think of the time I entered the toy shop with you on an afternoon gray with the threat of rain. Or do I recall images of you reminiscing, recounting the story you love to tell of your small stepson-to-be standing mute before racks, tables, shelves of toys? You would have purchased any of them for me, lead soldiers firing muskets, a mountain tunnel for my trains, even a magic cape sewn with planets and stars. But I never pulled my hands from my pockets. What I recall clearly is the way you shook your head with mirthless laughter each time you told the story down the years of the strange boy who turned his back on 100 toys. Only months before we entered the Impossible Toy Store, my father quit the family by performing the unfathomable trick of dying. Surely he could have reversed the magic that engrossed him as he lay on his bed in the darkened room. Surely he could have turned the key in the lock of himself and slipped the chains he chose to wear, like Houdini, another prince of the time. Was not the story you never tired of telling a slant account of a vexed and baffled boy who would not forgive his father for disappearing, nor you your entrance on the scene? For I had seen him glide from our home on a June evening, saw him lift his straw boater in the air, flash his broad Franklin Roosevelt smile, then turn and vault the hedge at the border of the lawn. His heels made sidewalk music down the street. Up in Maine. Mother drew me toward her on the lawn, kneeled and took my hand. You must call Harry Father now. Will you do that for me? I pulled my hand from hers and walked away. I see her kneeling on the grass, white arms at her sides. She turns and looks out toward the bay. The last meeting of my stepfather. The last time I saw Harry alive, I was leaving for home in another city. He settled in his chair with his paper, a man with something important to say. He began with his trip to France in the 20s. His cabbie drove up the hill of Montmartre, swept his hand over the scene below, Monsieur Paris. The gesture meant something to Harry. It had stayed with him 50 years. There should be places here, like they have over there, where people like you could meet with friends and over a glass or two of wine talk half the night of important things. He never said any such thing before. It meant, though your road will be different from mine, here is my blessing. Bloodlines. On the back of an old photograph of you, I found four words you wrote. They noted merely place and time. Mother, that sudden token of your writing, angular pitch of urgent, sloping letters, blew wide the door to the country we loved and warred in. Your sign, solid as a thumbprint, a gene map, never to appear anywhere in the world again. I'm going to read a semi-ghost story. It's not really, but there's a ghost in it in a way. And then one after that that's a real one. And the one that I'm going to read first is called The Revenant. And for the two or three people in the room who may not know what revenant means, it's from a French verb to return, to come back, and a revenant is an English word meaning one who has come back. Let's see here. The Revenant. I came, a stranger, an intruder. I arrived from long ago, and on a fur soft summer night, parked my car in tall shadows that half hid the house my father built. It rose in the darkness, still commanding the street at the head of the hill where the cliffs and the river meet. A young man came down the slate walk where I played as a child when June evenings were stitched with fireflies. He stood outside the hedges. Can I help you, sir? Thank you, I said. No, but I used to live here once. Oh, he said, then turned and walked briskly into the dark. No ghosts for him this evening. I might have said, but had sought to spare us both, that my father, when he was younger than I am now, had built this house and died suddenly after on the porch that faces south. What had I hoped to find in this mute return? That my unknown parent had inherited his house in death? That he was the true tenant, still there, in the shrubs, the garden, the insubstantial air? Did I expect to hear his laugh, to feel his hand upon my hair? Who now was the ghost, my father or myself, who, like a stone fallen out of space, had struck across the orbit of this young man, raising I cannot know what dust in the cliffs and precipices of his mind. The next poem is called Some Questions About a Ghost. And this, you don't need to know this, but New England, Maine, lots of things about that have Maine as a background. And I was sitting in the garage of a man who was a real tough egg. And all of a sudden, I don't know why, he asked me, do you believe in ghosts, Mark? And I don't remember what I said. I just wanted to hear him talk. And part of this is part of what he told me. You the one who bought the farm off the high road? Nobody told you the place is haunted? The druggist in the village gave me a look. They say the woman appears in an upper room staring out a window. I said I hadn't much time for spirits. Been a builder most of my life, roads, houses, worked on all the turnpike bridges, Portland to Augusta. Not a week after we settled in, I saw her around midnight. She stood with her back to the bed, a woman in a gown peering out toward the road. I thought it was Harriet, but Harriet lay asleep on the moonlit side of the bed. Couldn't see her face, wish I had. I've imagined 1,000 times a fox's snout, red eyes flaring. She turned, walked right past me, and vanished like breath on a mirror. I never told Harriet. Soon after, when Harriet was putting up paper in that room, she felt a chill and smelled a scent like cloves. The paper she had rolled out on the wall slid to the floor, then another and another. Listen here, Harriet snapped. Listen here. Robert and I own this place now. I've put in time fixing up this room, and I intend to finish. Harriet got on with the job. The paper stayed up on the wall and has ever since. That was the last we ever heard from the ghost while we lived at the farm. Had she found what she was looking for out there in the dark? Was she as scared of me as I was of her? One thing more. Why wasn't Harriet frightened? Several years ago, 1994, I had heart surgery. And I was up in Maine, where I think I said we have a house up there, a small house on an island. And I couldn't connect with anything up there, stuff that I really that really interests me. And this went on, and our vacation was dwindling, so I asked myself, what's going on with you? And this poem is the answer. Night Sweat. The poem I need to write is the poem of rage, not the poem of sinking into harmony with wind rhythms, wave sounds lapping this northern island, nor the poem of the round of seasons, effulgent summer dying into fall, nor of taking my place in the cycle of generations. I need to write how the great wind came on a filthy night, rammed up the coast, ripped spruce 80 feet tall and strewed them like straw over a neighbor's woodlot. A man who built his house deep in those woods and painted it black. I need to write of the squire on the crest of my hill who left a trail of stumps and ash from his house clear down to the bay, trashing a woman's land because her treetop smudged his view of sunsets, clouds, boats passing. How my daughters, both, were given halting, difficult sons of their night sweats, vigils, sorrows. But most how the surgeon split my heart with a whirling saw and split my chest with a whirling saw and took out my heart. O blooming world of chaos and decay, I want my old heart back, not this alien pump that was pressed, cut, chilled, changed, and held in hands remote from me as those of a man on a spacewalk working with delicate instruments in the violent dark. earlier after the surgery, stuff you repress. Earlier after the surgery, I was sitting out in the backyard and wrote something completely different, but it was also a reaction, at least in part, I guess, to the heart surgery. Lucky for the heart surgeons that every patient isn't like me, I guess. The connubial wrens. Yes to the golden moment that is gold a moment only in the cramped dirt garden of our backyard. Yes to the tottering wall, the blunt back porches of anonymous neighbors, the toys abandoned on flagstones, yellow tractor, dump truck, chunky cement mixer. Yes to the crows in their baseball umpire suits on the telephone wires, to the connubial wrens hunkering in the Chinese elm, its leaves still green. Yes to the black squirrel eyeing me from the gate, the herbs in their pots, sage, thyme, sweet marjoram, the jet flashing this instant overhead. Quite a different set of feelings. This is a poem called The Garden, in memory of my mother. For weeks you had been journeying into yourself, slowly at first, and writing occasional poems to mark certain junctions, dark and airy crossings. Then as the illness gathered and you began to shrink before our eyes like a figure disappearing in space, your flight became a kind of inward freefall. The last station you came to before the end was fear. Fear so insistent that in your hospital room above the city, now remote as Arcturus, you lay in a white silence, entirely alone. The living who came to you refused to countenance your journey. Your face drawn about the bone, eyes uprolled, mouth gone, contracted on a single point of terror. It was your daughter who loosed you from that mooring by naming names. Out of her own teeming conversations with herself, she knew that one must agree to meet with the dying under a favorite tree, out on the edge of town, in front of a rain-streaked shop, and walk partway with them, touching hands. At last you had found a pilot for your journey. It was a dusky afternoon in deep August. Shadows of leaves stirred on the walls of the room. She told you, now an unfamiliar small old lady, that she knew you would be able to do it. And she returned bright fables learned from you as a child. She said it is like the seasons following one another. She talked of seed sailing, of how the tall trees burn, of swallows blowing about in a gusty sky. She said there would be a garden bright with so many flowers, with walks and grasses. And your eyes widened at last before the end, the great fear left you. You grew easy in your pillows and stepped light as a girl into the banks of shadows that now drown the walls of the room. Three short poems written after my first trip with my wife to Prague. It was a return for her, not for me. It was my first trip to Europe. The first one is called Alchemy. Kafka lived in this small blue house that teeters and leans on Alchemy Street, where Emperor Rudolph installed scholars to coax tin into gold. It's just a shout from the castle of a thousand rooms. I'll ennoble the man who brews gold in a pot the emperor said. The castle, said Kafka, that we see from every point in golden Prague is a swarm of shadows. It isn't there. I've tested its reality with alchemical instruments of my own. It's built entirely, stone on stone, of air. At a Holocaust museum, in the photo mural, a boy of 12 looms in a crowd beside the transports. He wears a sweater buttoned to the throat against the chill, hefts a suitcase as though leaving with his family on a holiday. Big shoulders, chest, hair fresh cut, alert, strong face that fell to ash, melted in smoke, in ropes and sheets of snow flying over Poland. Decades later, in another country, my brother wore that face. Kabbalah, it's a real short poem. Prague is erasing itself. Stucco falls from sand-colored palaces. Black scaffolding climbs the spiky towers of Saint-Tine, grows greasy with disuse in rain. In the night, an old Jew dreams the grand rabbi has forgotten all the secret names of God. I found Prague very mysterious. During that time, it was when the communists, when it was a very, very stiff communist boot on the neck of the whole country. But I found it mysterious, strange, scaffolding all over the buildings, but very beautiful and haunting. Now it's filled with Americans, you know. It's a good sign. Another big preoccupation of mine has been the art of East Asia, mostly China and Japan. And there's a poem called The Thought Garden. I will build a thought garden behind my house. Raked sand or gravel flowing will stand for a stream, the sea, or trackless woods. Gnarled rocks anchored in twos, threes will be mountains, islands, plunging cliffs, or clusters of friends, perhaps, the poets of the bamboo grove who made boats of their poems and floated them out on the river. There will be no bright colors in my garden, evergreens, or moss that has no skin to shed, for we are talking not of evanescent things, but of the bones and marrow of the world. A poem called Return to the Island, and it's after a poem by Wang Wei, who was one of the great Chinese poets of the golden age of Chinese poetry, the Tang Dynasty. And he was a Buddhist and wrote wonderful things, and he's traditionally thought to be the father of landscape painting. I wonder how they came to that. Return to the island. The white morning sun climbs above our cottage, dispelling dawn's chill, rousing thrushes, wrens, waxwings that dart to our trees and bushes. I love their chatter and song, their quick flight, their perfect bodies, and how branches bend or spring up as they leave or light. I cook eggs and boil water for tea. You ask what laws rule failure or success? Shouts of children in the orchard raise a scatter of birds. Pedagogy. I have to laugh myself when I read this. My first grade teacher, Pearl Lorraine Wright, stood before her class, her hair a thin, fleecy cloud. Children, It's not good for your eyes to wear rubbers all day in school. That's what she said. Put them in the cloakroom, please. Even then, I smiled behind my hand. Children, this is how to open a new book without cracking the spine. I settle in my study out of a whirling storm, snap on the gooseneck lamp, and open a new book, Dawn of Art, Paintings from the Chauvet Cave. Set the spine on the desk, press the boards down, and smooth out the pages a few at a time, half right, half left, and think of Miss Wright in Palisades School Number 4 in a town that no longer exists. Bisons, horses, rhinos, lions march across the golden wall of the cave, my snow boots neatly placed in the hall closet. Talk about influence. Spaces, excuse me, leave a space for the unexpected, the red sun put out by fog at noon, the tree backlit on our walk that night, a vast face on the fog scrim, the adagio of Mahler's Fifth on the radio when we came in, played not like a dirge, but a song. Few new poems, and I guess I'll close with those. I'm trying to sort of keep on time. And then if anybody wants to ask some questions, please do. Silence at 5 a.m. This appeared in Rhino, Vinyl Haven, Maine. Eagles have come back to the island. Osprey are plentiful again. Soon they will climb and circle in threes and fours, almost out of sight, tootling to each other. Last night at dusk, a cormorant burst from its strip of water by the stone bridge. But where are my mourning birds that crisscrossed our backyard summer after summer? Finches, gold and purple, black-capped chickadees, flights of anxious waxwings. Where is the high, sweet, five-note piccolo call of the white-throated sparrow? The box of clouds. I keep a box in my study where I store things that are useful sometimes in adversity. I keep not one but three Indian head pennies and old Chinese coins with circlets and squares cut in their centers. My shoes scuff them up in an overblown garden. I keep stamps in odd colors, moss, mauve, diamond gray. They looked obsolete the day they were minted. Feathers that drop from the sky, my Airedale's bark, a child's cry. I keep a fragrance bottle my muse gave me when I met her in a blue hotel, and she startled me into remembering who I am. The revelation, another short one. I rise in the night and encounter a strange new scent when I turn my head just so, at last, a visit from the other world. Only mother would have the fortitude to travel all that way. And in a pleasant mood, to judge by the freshness and sweetness of the scent, to tell me I have long been forgiven and to learn I long ago forgave her. I declare an amnesty. Everyone is forgiven. Thank you very, very, very much.